My name is Nick Corbishley. I was born in the UK just under 47 years ago. I have been living in Barcelona for the last 22, 23 years, though I'm spending quite a lot of time in Mexico, my country-in-law. I'm a journalist. I've been writing for about 11, 12 years. And I generally cover issues of geopolitics in Latin America. But also, I've been writing a lot about the war on cash for the last 10 years. Also, central bank digital currencies. And a couple of years ago, I published a book called Scanned: Why Vaccine Passports and Digital Identity Will Mean the End of Privacy and Personal Freedom.
Well, hang on, because you call it a war on cash, but surely this is actually more of just a technological change, because it's become much cheaper and easier to move money around electronically. So cash is slowly fading into the distance like a kind of dinosaur.
Well, that's what we're told. I mean, that is the official story, where we're told that, cash is kind of making a, what should we say, a genteel exit from stage. But I mean, like, the reality is that the war is happening constantly all around us. If you're reducing the possibility of actually getting your hands on cash, which is what's been happening in just about every Western country, then yeah, people are gonna kind of like turn to alternatives. This is not to say that, there isn't a generational element to this. I think people who are probably under the age of 40 are more likely to use digital payment methods than they are to use cash. But I mean, like, if you make something harder and harder to do, and then you turn around, which is what basically banks especially have done, but also, big box retailers, governments, payment processors, central banks, they've all kind of, like, over the last 10 years, they've been working together to make it more and more difficult to access or to use cash.
Well, yeah, but the reason they're doing that is surely it's because it's actually a lot more expensive for them to be processing cash with cashiers and say, for example, to process a check. You need a lot of human input, and they have to pay those people wages. And I mean, you can understand why the banks might incentivize people to use electronic things, like, install apps in order to transfer money around rather than to pay a check into the bank.
You can absolutely understand why banks do that. It makes perfect sense from a bank's perspective. For banks, I mean, a perfect bank is a bank without bankers, or at least without bank clerks. You would much rather, a bank would much rather have zero branches than have the number of branches it has right now. So yes, from the perspective of a commercial bank, especially a large commercial bank, they would much rather not use cash. They'd much rather their customers didn't get access to cash, because when you have digital payments, they can make a lot more money on that. It costs them a lot less. They can put a lot more fees, they can put fees all the time on digital money. And you've also got the data that you can accumulate about your customers that you can't do with cash. So obviously banks are, absolutely hard geared to want to kill cash. The question is whether or not that is a good thing for the broader society, whether that is a good thing for every individual, whether that is even a good thing for the economy, for the stability of the economy. So I mean, like, we shouldn't be running our economies based on what is good or not for the banks we have, which basically we more or less bailed out in 2008 with public money. So I mean, like, we should be wary about letting banks decide the future direction of money.
Yeah, I mean, there hasn't been much of a public debate, certainly here in the UK, but there has been quite a reasonably well attended, if I can call it that, a consultation that the Bank of England have been running on central bank digital currencies.
Yeah, that happened. I've not actually read many of the replies. I know that a lot of the replies were not very, should we say, enthusiastic about the idea of the digital pound, or the Bitcoin, or whatever you want to call it. But I mean, like, this is kind of par for the course. I mean, like, in most of these consultations, so the ECB has done a similar consultation. When these consultations take place, generally speaking, the response is not very positive. But the central bank tends to just ignore that or go on with that, and they might make tiny little tweaks to their plans. But they're not going to suddenly turn around and say, well, you know, we had overwhelmingly negative response, let's just stop that now. Let's go back to where we were before. I think that these consultations generally have two purposes behind them. One, they generally do want to hear from important, to borrow a word from the World Economic Forum, stakeholders. They clearly want to hear from organizations like UK Finance. And even UK Finance, if you look at its response, it wasn't very enthusiastic. It is worried about what the central bank digital currency would mean for their future, for the future of the commercial banks in the UK, especially the big four commercial banks. So they're very much interested in what they get from them. But I mean, like, what Joe Bloggs says is, I think, of much lesser import. But yes, at least there is some kind of consultation process taking place. What I would much rather see taking place is to have a much wider debate about these things. And I would say, I mean, in the UK, would you say about there not being much in the way of public debate? I think compared to a lot of countries, thanks in part to what has happened over the last month and a half with Nigel Farage, I think that at least this has generated some kind of discussion about the nature of money, the direction.
Well, yeah, and also the power of banks, most definitely. I mean, we've just touched on it briefly. You know, you're talking about that banks get a lot more information from you if they're processing money electronically rather than cash. I mean, we're also in the situation, aren't you, whether it's cash or otherwise, if people are using these cards at supermarkets, etc., that they are also handing over a lot of information about their consumption habits, their personal preferences, in fact, a massive amount over to Tesco's or, you know, their club card and this kind of thing. And people do these things because there's a bit of a discount. So there's a fantastic amount more information around about how we spend our money and what we spend it on. And I wonder, do you think that there is any, you know, do the banks actually use the information that we give them when we're using our money electronically? Because clearly they can see exactly, with cash you can't, but they can see exactly where we're spending our money, when and how much.
Yeah, I mean, like, they want to know as much as they can about their customers. It's a little bit like insurance companies wanting to know as much as they can about their policyholders. The more you know, the less risk you're taking. And in my book, Scanned, I mentioned a document by the IMF, which was talking about how our internet footprint, what we do on the internet, what we look for on the internet, what we consume on social media, what we share on social media, all of these things will be used more and more by banks in terms of developing a broader profile of their customers. And this is kind of like what we saw with the Nigel Farage scandal. You know, they had 40 pages, and a lot of this stuff, the information, was really badly analyzed and digested by whoever was treating this data. And they reached some bizarre conclusions, like the idea that, you know, because Nigel Farage was sharing or liking a tweet from Ricky Gervais, he was clearly a racist. These sort of things. It's the fact that they are going there and they're using this information. They're building up these profiles, I don't know for sure whether or not they're actually sharing consumer data or customer data. I don't think so, but I mean, like, just to have that much of a data trail, it clearly makes it much easier to manage your customers, to manage your risks, than when you have people using cash.
Yeah, I mean, these databases are surely, I mean, they're worth money, aren't they? As we've seen with the leak of the police files over the last week or so, the Police Service of Northern Ireland, you know, to the real IRA, this kind of thing is worth a lot of money. You know, all the names and addresses of the, you know, these databases, you know, they're kind of ephemeral, and we're given all sorts of assurances. Yeah. Your data will not be shared or whatever. But then if someone could get their hands on it, this is hot property. This is worth a lot of money.
It is absolutely. I mean, it's data is the new oil, as they started saying many years ago, and it has an incredible amount of value depending on what the data is to other individuals or organizations, and there's no way of making these data completely 100% secure. If there's one thing we've learned from the last, I don't know, 5-10 years, it is that even the largest, most sophisticated technological companies are prone to being targets of hacks and can have their data targeted and I can't think of the word, but yeah, basically hacked. No database is fully impregnable. And this is why, as I say in my book Scanned, you basically, the idea of having this kind of database society, this digitized economy and digitized governance, totally digitized governance, as we have seen kind of like being developed in Ukraine of all places, is exceptionally dangerous. Because
what is going on in Ukraine then? What is this digitized governance? I've not come across this before.
Okay, so Ukraine, even before the war, launched a platform called DIA, D-I-I-A, which is basically kind of like digital governance and identity system. The idea being to kind of like basically put all forms of government services on the internet accessible to users, but on the basis that users all have a digital identity. And they've done a good job of it. They've digitized a lot. And they've even, you know, they're talking about digitizing voting, which most voting experts say is definite no, you don't want to go there. And I think it was earlier this year at Davos that Samantha Powers, who is like the chief of USAID, which is affiliated with the CIA, is basically the soft power arm of Washington's,
British Council is for the Brits.
A little bit, probably more involved in kind of like subversive and should we say, what's the word? Kind of counter intelligence operations, etc. In other countries, it's like the happy face, the nice face of the CIA. It's certainly been involved in quite a few color revolutions and the like in Eastern Europe, Latin America, Africa, and other places. But I mean, basically, she was in Davos at the beginning of this year, basically lauding this DIA system, saying that it is ready to be exported to other parts of the world. And DIA has been funded by, in large part, by USAID. It's been funded by the United Nations. It's been funded by the European Union. So it's a curious little thing. It's a story that most people haven't heard. And, you know, we've seen in previous conflicts how they have been used often by Washington and other players to trial certain digital technologies. We've seen it in Afghanistan. They used They collected the biometric data of millions of Afghan citizens, which ended up falling into the hands, I believe, of the Taliban. So, I mean, like, this is what we've seen happen in Ukraine. Ukraine is desperate to be one of the first countries to kill cash. So a couple of months ago, two senior advisors to Zelensky came out and said that they are very serious. They're very keen to become the first country to absolutely kill cash. Again, a story that didn't get much traction, didn't get much attention on, especially in the mainstream. But yeah, so I mean, like, Ukraine is being used quite aggressively as a kind of like trial, as a testing ground for digital surveillance and control systems.
Okay, well, look, we've got to make, I think, the distinction here between just digital money, which can obviously be traced, etc. You know, it doesn't have the anonymity of cash. So I suppose the mafia aren't that keen on digital currencies and digital money, just like they're not very keen on emails. They much rather meet and do their dirty deals face to face. But you know, there is a difference, isn't there, between this digital money and what's being floated with the central bank digital currencies. You know, although, you know, for a lot of people, they seem to merge into one. Can you just bring a bit of a distinction between, you know, your credit card with your little chip in it and your chip and pin, and now you're waving your little card in front of a card reader, and the central bank digital currencies? What's this idea that's coming down the line?
I mean, like you said, they're both digital forms of money. In basic form, they're very similar. The difference is that when we use a credit card or a debit card, we're using what might be described as private money. So using money that's essentially belongs to, or is created by, when you get a loan from your bank, is money that is created by the private banking system. So in the UK, the Bank of England came out a few years ago and essentially admitted that, yes, 97% of all the money that is in circulation in the UK takes this form. It is private money. And it's only really the cash that we use, the notes and the coins, which is actually public money, which is money that is created directly by the government or central bank. And what the central banks are saying is, because we're using more and more digital money in this kind of private digital money, then, you know, in order to protect public money, we need to have a central bank digital currency. And when this kind of like was first being talked about a few years ago, what was interesting is that they were like saying, like, the, you know, what the form this could take, the retail central bank digital currency, the form it would take would be almost like having a direct bank account, every person, every business having a direct bank account with the central bank. And that was kind of like how it was being framed at the beginning. And now, as we're seeing much more detail come out, it's actually, you know, almost all of the major central banks are talking about setting up a system whereby the private commercial banks will be managing it. You will have intermediaries. So it's like one of the major benefits that were first kind of like presented a few years ago about central bank digital currencies, that doesn't seem to be relevant. You will have an account with the Bank of England, and if you are English, through your local bank, through your commercial bank. And I would say the bigger issue is the question of how this money could be managed. And this is where you get to what is called programmable money. And this is where you start seeing a major difference in the way money could be in the future. And programmable money is this idea that you can essentially, or the issuer of the money can affect a purchase before it is being made. So if you, let's say, and there was actually an article in the Telegraph a couple of years ago where the Bank of England was almost like asking for permission from the government to go ahead with this kind of model. And again, until quite recently, they were very open about the wonders of programmable money, this idea that you can kind of like tinker with it, you can tweak it, you can ensure that maybe somebody is not spending so much money in certain products that may be damaging for their health, as one example. But I mean, like, there are darker implications even more than that, which is, for example, that they could maybe they could stop you from being able to use your account at all. And this is where the debanking scandal that has happened over the last couple of months in the UK is so important, because it shows that banks, even in the current system, are quite content when they are presented with what they consider is a risky customer. They are quite content to simply close that customer's account down. And in some cases in the US, if you are, you know, if you have your bank account closed down, that would actually mean that you can't even access your account, your money, for a certain period of time. And it may be actually quite a long period of time. So if you can imagine a system where it's almost like it would be AI managed, artificial intelligence managed, you could suddenly find yourself wanting to buy, I don't know, pay for a meal in a restaurant or whatever, and suddenly your account no longer exists. For some reason, your money can be stopped, that purchase can be stopped, or your account can be frozen. And I can imagine a world in which where you have central bank digital currencies, where it's an almost more impersonal system, where you would have to not only discuss this, well, you'd have to go to your local bank account, your local bank, to discuss this. You would have to find somebody at the central bank to broach why it is your money has suddenly stopped, why your bank account is no longer usable. Other possible uses of programmable money that have been suggested would be having money that has an expiration date, so that you could encourage people to spend money more readily, more quickly, rather than saving it. So you could maybe in a recession, central banks could inject money into people's banks accounts, but they would have only a certain period of time to spend that money. Alternative, what the scary thing is, that you could suddenly find your money suddenly being taken out of your bank account. So it is an incredible amount of power to be giving to, I would say, central banks and governments that have not exactly behaved in ways that should generate our trust over decades, I would argue, but certainly over the last few years.
Yeah, well, I mean, it reflects, I suppose, the power, balance of power between the banks and our elected governments, particularly here in Britain. I mean, we've got, after 2008 wasn't the only bailout, there were further bailouts in 2019, yeah, which weren't so much talked about. And, you know, it seems that when the banks stamp their feet, throw their toys out of the pram, whenever they do that and say, look, you know, things are going really badly for us, if you don't give us some money, the cash points are going to stop working and people's bank accounts are going to be robbed. You know, they're basically, loads of money will be taken out of, you know, so the government really doesn't want this. And so they just do what the banks seem to want. it does seem as if this whole agenda is coming through. Yes, it's good for the banks, but that there's been very little democratic input. But look, also, I think we owe it to the rest of the world to look around a little bit to see what's going on in other countries. And I know in Nigeria, quite a lot's been happening, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Nigeria is the first largest, or was the first largest economy to launch a central bank digital currency, the so-called E-Naira, which was, I think, in October 2021. And I think it's a really interesting case study that, again, is just not getting the attention it probably deserves. So Nigeria is the largest economy in Africa. It's the most populous country in Africa. And it's the, and like I said, it's the first country to launch a central bank digital currency. And the first year or so, it was an incredible flop. It didn't reach anywhere near the kind of circulation, the amount of customer use that it was hoping for. Fewer than a million people had downloaded the application in a country of 230 million. And most of those were not using it. So, I mean, like, they downloaded the app. So it was a disaster. The IMF, even the IMF came out and said, you know, this is not working well. So in around about October last year, the government, which conveniently was the first year anniversary of its launch, the central bank and the government began talking about the need to do a demonetization program, which is something that countries from time to time do. They withdraw certain notes from circulation in order to replace them with other notes, with new notes. And India probably carried out the most famous or the most infamous demonetization program in 2016, when they withdrew 84%, if I'm not mistaken, of the cash in circulation with zero warning, causing absolute devastation. That was in India in 2016. Nigeria gave a little bit more warning, but what they essentially did was, in January this year, they began telling people to come in and bring in their cash, the high denomination notes they had. And in Nigeria, when you have a high denomination note, that basically, I think, is like 10 quid. It's probably less than that now, because Nigeria has very, very high inflation and its currency is constantly losing value. So, I mean, they told people to bring in their high denomination notes, which they did. But they didn't have any new notes to give them back. And this is when they started to have serious economic problems. They withdrew more than half of the cash from the system, and they didn't put any new money in. And this caused, as happened in India in 2016, this caused huge problems. Businesses went out of business. People were not able to pay for their most basic things. They were not able to pay for their medical bills. They were not able to pay for their prescription medicines. They were not able to pay for anything. This caused huge. So you had huge protests. You had burning downs of, you know, people burnt down bank branches. And the Supreme Court got involved and told the central bank, look, you've got to stop this experiment. You've got to get this money back in. And the central bank, for about 2 weeks, 3 weeks, refused. Basically disobeyed the Supreme Court. So when we talk about power, I mean, this was an enormous statement. This was a central bank saying, we are going to ignore the Supreme Court. And they carried on with this program until eventually they backed down.
So when people brought in their high denomination notes, what were they getting in return? Some sort of credit on their central bank digital currency app on their phone?
No, I mean, it was, as far as I was aware, they were going in, they were giving in their money. I presume the bank was taking note of the money they'd received, but they weren't getting anything in return. So the idea of this, I mean, there were two things happening. So first of all, the central bank desperately wanted people to start using e-Naira. The madness of this is that most people in Nigeria cannot use the e-Naira even if they wanted to, because most people don't have a bank account and most people don't have a smartphone. So from day one, it was absolutely flawed. So people were taking in their money and they were getting nothing in return. And it was an absolute scandal, yet it was not getting reported anywhere. I mean, I think I was, even in the alternative media, I was one of the few people who actually consistently reported. I mean, I did like 5 or 6 articles about what happened in Nigeria. So, I mean, the other reason why this happened, was because the central bank governor in Nigeria wanted to be president of Nigeria. He was tired of being central bank governor and he wanted the top job, and elections were coming. So he basically, he presented himself in the primaries for the leading party, the governing party, and he lost against one of his bitter rivals. And leading up to the election, which was, I think, in February, they basically announced that day when the deadline, the cutoff point was for introducing your money, so taking your money to the bank. Now, after that deadline, you know, any money you took in would not even be registered. So, I mean, like the idea, his idea, his thinking was that this bitter rival of his, almost all of his electoral machinery was based around buying votes. So if they could take cash out of the system, then his bitter rival would not be able to buy votes in the elections and would lose. Which, I mean, like, it's insane. It's one person's political ambitions allowing, basically triggering, being used to deprive a country of 220 million of half of their money supply. And I mean, Nigeria is a country that depends on cash, just like most emerging or developing countries do. And we don't really know how many people died as a direct result of this, but we know people did because they were unable to get healthcare.
Well, it sounds a bit like Ukraine. You know, obviously Ukraine is in more ways than just financially, but, you know, being used as almost a playground by the the central bankers. What about India? And you mentioned India briefly there, but I know these things are moving forward in China, and China, of course, is notorious for its social credit system, where they profile everybody, and certain people are considered good citizens, others bad citizens. And so, you know, some can do things and others can't, say, for example, use air travel or the bullet trains and this kind of thing. So how's things going in China and India?
Well, they're moving along. I mean, they're leading the way, I would say. I mean, like the e-Naira has so far been a disaster, but China is taking a much more incremental approach to this. So China began its CBDC plan almost 10 years ago in 2014. And like its social credit system, it is developing this in a kind of very careful, very considered manner, launching when the Chinese government thinks the system is more or less ready, they will launch it in very small localities, then they will expand it. And as far as I'm aware, the digital yuan pilot programs are now in 22-23 different parts of China. Those could be cities, those could be regions. So I mean, like it's at a point where I think China could any moment more or less just launch it nationwide. So that is China. India is a bit further behind, but they're also at the pilot stage for the digital rupee. India has a massive advantage over most Western countries, which is that it has the biggest digital identity, biometrically enabled digital identity program on the planet, with almost 1.4 billion, 1.4 billion people involved. I think that the number of people now in India who are not on the so-called Aadhaar database is probably less than 5%. So if you are going to launch a central bank digital currency, you absolutely need a digital identity program fully established and fully functioning. And this is in the case of China and India, both have that. And I think this is one of the reasons why they're kind of like leagues ahead of the countries, most of the countries in the West. I mean, you'll see, I mean, like everywhere you look, right now, you will see that, you know, any country that is at the development stage of central bank digital currency is also developing or even rolling out a digital identity system. So the two things go hand in hand.
You've been looking at Ukraine. We did mention them earlier as this sort of test base, and there seems to have been some changing attitudes. I mean, you're down in Spain with some quite senior people in Spain starting to question the whole wisdom of this. Now, obviously, there are many, many, many people right across Europe and the United States as they see the inflation rates rising, the cost of living crisis kicking in. You know, even the pay awards that have been given to nurses and teachers in Britain are actually pay cuts because of inflation. And yet all the money that seems to be being funneled over to Zelensky in Ukraine doesn't seem to make much sense. So what's been going on in Spain then?
Well, I mean, like this came out of the blue. So, I mean, we've had, much like in the UK, we've had a year and a half of more or less one message about the Ukraine war, which is Ukraine was invaded completely unjustly by Russia. Russia had no justification for taking such an action, and it has been a terrible victim of that invasion since then. And every single possible means must be taken to defend Ukraine against Russia. And that includes the sanctions you mentioned, which have done enormous damage to the European Union's economy and the UK's economy, and I would argue also the global economy, by fueling this huge surge in inflation. Though I would say, I mean, like, it has to be noted that inflation was already beginning to take off before the Ukraine war. Lots and lots of politicians in the West tried to use the Ukraine war as the only cause of inflation. But I mean, like, I remember writing about inflation in 2021 as it began creeping up. And in many countries, it was already well above kind of the target level for the central bank, well before the war. So that has to be said. But yeah, I mean, basically, Spain has been following, towing the NATO line for the last year and a half, very faithfully, and that has been like very much reflected in the media. But that, I would say, changed significantly this week when, I think his name is José Luis Cebrán, if I'm not mistaken. Let me just double check. I've got the article here. José Luis Cebrán wrote an article in El País that essentially started arguing that maybe this was a bad idea. He started saying that, he said in his article that this war in Ukraine is not just a war about an invader and a poor defenseless country that is trying to defend itself. He actually came out and said this is a proxy war. And he began saying that, yes, this is not in the interest long term of the European Union and is actually potentially a threat to the long term survival of the European Union as it kind of becomes its own interests become supplanted by the objectives of the NATO military alliance. Those are his exact words. It's interesting, the title of this article, In Defense of Ukraine to the Death of the Ukrainians. So it's quite a vivid image that, you know, you could imagine some other article, maybe in Russia, writing, or some other somewhere in, let's say, India, or a country that is not a NATO member, coming out of an important publication. I mean, El País is kind of like the Guardian of Spain. It is a very, very important publication is the New York Times of Spain. And José Luis Cebrán is the founder of this newspaper. He was the person who was the president of the holding company until I think 2018. He is also, interestingly, the only Spanish member, permanent member of the Bilderberg Group. So this is a man, this is not just some journalist. This is, he's consistently in the list of the top 40, 50 most influential Spanish people. This is, I think, a very important step within Spain. I believe what they're trying to do is to soften up public opinion towards the idea of essentially abandoning the Ukraine cause, which, as we've seen in with the pandemic and the vaccines and the vaccine passports, it's, before governments take a very, very big U-turn on overarching policy that has affected all of our lives, they have to soften up public opinion. They have to start shifting the way people think towards the subject at hand, subtly, little by little, before actually taking that action.
Many of the Western countries, particularly in the NATO alliance and the EU and the United States, do seem to be sort of implementing these things in unison. It's almost as if most of the decisions are really being made by these transnational corporations rather than, and governments are sort of standing on the sidelines watching as these companies that they totally rely on for their tax and that threaten to leave the country if they try to regulate them. The governments are kind of powerless in that situation. The big worry for me with these profiling and databases and use of money, this kind of thing, is really looking back at the Second World War. And I read probably 20 years ago a book by Edwin Black called IBM and the Holocaust, where he explains how Nazi Germany was profiling everybody in the country and also in occupied Europe as they moved eastwards and westwards, and that these Hollerith machines supplied by IBM were used to, for example, they'd press a button in the morning, a whole bunch of punch cards would come out and a printed list of who to arrest. So, for example, if they wanted to arrest all of the Jews in a particular town, they just pressed a button and a list of the addresses came out. So this is what bothers me about the modern versions of these massive databases. And I'd just like to sort of wind up, Nick, by saying how do you think someone that knows what's going on in the world of these digital currencies and their implications of profiling individuals, what can we do to resist this, to stop it?
I think number one is to raise awareness, is to get people talking. And I think that this, to a certain extent, is happening in quite a few places. It's happening in a very, very slow at a very slow pace. But there is a conversation taken. I mean, I take a certain amount of hope from what has happened in the UK in the last couple of months. The fact that, you've had front page newspaper stories about the debanking phenomenon, which is something that I wrote about before what was happening with Nigel Farage. And I think that in Spain, there was an interesting, I think the important thing is to not give in to fatalism, because there have been moments in the past where it seems like we are facing an almost insurmountable, let's use the word enemy. And when you are talking about central banks, there are few institutions on the planet that are as powerful as central banks, and government, in league with governments, in league with the biggest banks on the high street, in league with MasterCard and Visa, in league with the tech companies. So it seems like, this is just an alliance of enemies that are just impossible to fight against. But I think that if we go back, I remember a few years ago when it seemed almost inevitable that we were going to have the Trans-Pacific Partnership and we were going to have the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, the TPP and the TTIP. And I remember writing about these kind of like so-called free trade agreements, which were really about investment protection treaties. And it seemed at the time that it was going to be impossible to stop them. And there was a moment, but I mean, like there was, I think that there was enough attention generated by mainly independent journalists, mainly by podcasts, mainly by people who just want to get this information out there, that in Europe, for example, 1.7 million people signed a petition against the TTIP. In the US, it became, I would argue, a defining topic in the 2016 elections, and probably was one of the main factors in Trump's victory over Clinton. So, I mean, I think that we have to be very careful about falling into defeatism and fatalism. I still have hope that this can be stopped. And I would love to leave you with one story from Spain, because Spain is a country that is still much more, where cash is much more used and readily available than it is in the UK. It's still the number one payment method. So, I mean, in the UK, I think debit cards overtook cash about 6 years ago or something like that. And it's been, you know, since then, cash has declined significantly. In Spain, cash is still the number one payment method. And, but I mean, like the banks in Spain, just like the banks in the UK, have gradually, little by little, been closing all their branches, closing ATMs, making it harder and harder to get hold of cash. Retailers were starting to make it harder to use cash. So last year, there was kind of like a mini revolution among pensioners in Spain, where they began organizing on social media. Ironically, they began organizing on through WhatsApp, through Twitter, through Facebook, through Telegram. And they began threatening the banks with kind of like credit card and debit card payment holidays. And it was interesting because the moment they started threatening to take these actions, the banks took a few steps back. The banks kind of like chickened out to a certain degree. They began promising to take actions to make it easier for their customers to use cash, to help them use the ATMs or the cash points. And even more importantly, shortly after that, the Spanish government came out and passed a law essentially obligating retailers and hospitality companies to accept cash as a means of payment. And if as a business you refuse to accept cash, you can face fines of up to 10,000 euros. So, I mean, like, this was an action that lasted 2 or 3 weeks, and it had long-term consequences. So I think that there are some serious lessons that people can learn from this. Number one, I think elderly people, I mean, like, in most countries, so like if you're talking about the UK, like, you know, anybody over the age of 60 is generally very badly treated by their banks. But if you look at who has money in the banks, who owns capital in the UK, it is people over the age of 50. And if they actually begin organizing, if they begin showing, I mean, like, there's too much of an attitude in my mind of kind of like subservience towards the banks. And the reality is the banks without our money have no existence. They have no business model. And they just never reminded of this. So I think what happened last year in Spain, they simply reminded the banks whose money it is they were using to generate their profits and their returns and their fees, etc., etc. And I think it's really important that people don't call it quits, don't give up on this. I mean, like, this is a battle. I mean, like, money is the system of money we have defines the quality of life we have. It defines the distribution of power within a country. It is absolutely fundamental to the democratic system we have. So, I mean, like, this is something that has to be opposed, and it has to be fought to the last man, in my view. And the only way we have any chance of doing that is if we get the word out.
Well, the central banks will come back to you and they will say, well, actually, these central bank digital currencies are quite handy because the economy is getting rather shaky, both in the United States and Europe and other parts of the world. Even the Chinese economy is starting to turn downwards. And if, God forbid, it all starts falling down, at least we've got these central bank digital currencies as a means of exchange to kind of keep things going and stop people starving.
And I would say to that, there may be certain positive things that central bank digital currencies can offer. The problem is that we live in democratic countries, or supposedly democratic countries, and central banks are not democratic and they're not accountable. And they have not done much to win our trust over the last 20, 30, 40, 50 years. They have, I would argue, been one of the most important forces in the massive shift in income and wealth disparities over the last 20 years. Did this kind of accelerate in 2008? I mean, at the very least, if we begin to mobilize against central bank digital currencies, at least we may have a role in shaping the legislation and the rules and the regulations that govern the form those central bank digital currencies take. Because as things currently stand, it's going to be virtually a diktat upon us. I readily admit that there are potential positives the central bank digital currencies offer. But if they are written, if they're rolled out, they are developed purely in the interest of central banks and the, the main constituencies of central banks, the interest groups that central banks represent, which is largely the commercial banks, the biggest commercial banks, then we are going to live in an economy that is far worse than the economy we live in today.
I suppose it's a little bit like the threshing machine so hated by the Luddites. It's not the actual technology, it's who owns and controls it that really annoyed them, you know, because they were basically completely shut out of the system, of the control of this new technology that was arriving in the countryside back in the 1700s. Anyway, look, Nick, how do listeners follow your work on social media and get hold of your book?
Okay, the book is, like I said, it's called Scanned, and you can get it from Amazon, you can get it from certain independent bookshops, but the easiest place to get it would be either from Amazon or from the publisher itself, Chelsea Green. And if people want to follow me on Twitter, the handle is Nick Corbishley, Corbishley. I also have a blog, which is quite simply nickcorbishley.com.
Okay, Nick, thanks very much for joining us.